Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Tonight at the American Museum of Natural History at the Penn American Center's annual gala, the organization of writers will be honoring the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo at its Freedom of Expression Courage Award. Penn's decision to honor Hebdo may seem like a natural, but among writers it has been a decision that has divided the group. Penn members withdrew from the gala, novelist Peter Carey, Michael Ondaatje, Francine Prose, Teju Cole, and Taya Selassie. By now, a total of 145 writers have signed a letter in protesting Penn's decision to honor Charlie Hebdo. By honoring the magazine, the letter says, quote, Penn is not simply conveying support for freedom of expression, but also valorizing selectively offensive material, material that intensifies the anti-Islamic, anti-Maghreb, anti-Arab sentiments already prevalent in the Western world. NYU is hosting a discussion today on the controversy with Penn Executive Director Suzanne Nostell, Charlie Hebdo staff members, and others. Nostell told WNYC last week that from her perspective, the criticism of the award was misplaced.
For us, this award really is about courage and not about cartoons or the specific content. It's about a group of people who, in the face of a firebombing of their office in 2011 and the killings earlier this year, have soldiered on in their mission, which, if you listen to them and you review in a probing way their cartoons, we think is pretty squarely satirical.
And Salman Rushdie considers the Penn Award a note of clarity that critics are trying to deny with their hand-wringing complaints. Here is his letter. It is quite right that Penn should honor Charlie Hebdo's sacrifice and condemn their murder without these disgusting buts, Rushdie wrote. This issue has nothing to do with an oppressed and disadvantaged minority. It has everything to do with the battle against fanatical Islam, which is highly organized, well-funded, and which seeks to terrify us all, Muslims as well as non-Muslims, into a cowed silence. Salman Rushdie denounces a denunciation that now has 145 signatories opposing Penn's decision to honor Charlie Hebdo. Writer and journalist Amitabha Kumar is one of the 145 signatories, and in a conversation today, he conveyed considerable discomfort over giving Charlie Hebdo this prize.
I think one should pause before saying we are all Charlie, or at least ask what does it mean for people, especially for writers, to agree completely with a position and to ask, are there differences across the world among people who are standing for a particular right? Is the issue more complicated?
How is giving them an award, Penn giving them an award for freedom of expression, simplifying the matter in any sense?
It raises the question, for example, is anyone else more deserving of the award? I mean, this is an issue that arises, I guess, with any prize that is given. You know, you're giving a prize for the best book. You ask, wasn't the other book more interesting? Or why are we looking away from this third book, which came out from a small press? In this case, we ask a similar question. Let's say there's a whistleblower. They have exercised courage. They have written or spoken against terrorism of another sort. It is the terrorism of the state, for example. Were they not deserving?
Is it possible for them all to be deserving, or is there something specifically that disqualifies Charlie Hebdo from receiving an award of this type under any circumstances, in your view?
That's a great question. Some people would argue that it does disqualify them. I'm not there. Instead, what I'm more perturbed by is the fact that an awful lot of people seem to be quite agreed that the award should be given and any question raised should be dismissed. And the particular stance I have taken is to say, wait a minute, why is so much vitriol being poured over six writers, or now maybe 200 writers, members of Penn, who have raised a question? So, in other words, John, I'm saying it's not so much that there's a disqualification for these folks in particular, but I'm very much interested in why is a particular culture or a whole nation interested in dismissing protest on this issue?
What about social change? Isn't it a result of very provocative writings? I mean, if we're going to look at Martin Luther, his writings could be viewed as extraordinarily provocative, perhaps even bringing on a religious war in Europe. The only way to get there is for people to articulate arguments that are very, very shocking in the beginning.
Sure, sure. Why is one argument taken as shocking and someone else's struggle, let's say another writer who is also a Muslim, who gets hacked to death in a public marketplace in Bangladesh, why is, for example, that not the occasion for people to be holding signs all over the world saying, I am Avijit Roy, you know? So the point is not that a speech is shocking. It's more like, who else has engaged in shocking speech that, however, is a bit more progressive, or if not a bit more, even a lot more progressive? A lot of people in Pakistan, for example, are mourning the death, the shooting of a young woman called Sabine Mahmood, who had organized this wonderful cultural space that was a rebuke to all kinds of fundamentalists, you know, and was in some ways a critique of the system in Pakistan. I did not see a lot of people in Paris or New York or London holding up signs or joining the protesters who said, I am Sabine Mahmood.
Well, we covered that story on this program, and I'm not saying we walked or marched in the streets. We didn't march in the streets about Charlie Hebdo either. Yes. I guess I'm wondering if by your argument with Penn that to give this award to Charlie Hebdo, they have to consider giving a similar award to this group in Texas that had the Muhammad cartoon contest that brought on the gunman over the weekend. Would you say that by Penn's argument, these groups are equivalent?
John, I teach in a classroom here at Poughkeepsie at Vassar College. I try to tell my students not to reach for the lowest hanging fruit. And I'm tempted to myself sometimes reach for the lowest hanging fruit. And I would want to mock Penn by saying, so why don't you give an award for, you know, why don't we say I am Pam Geller? I think they are open to that charge. I don't necessarily want to take that road. I think a little bit of introspection would be most welcome on this question. You know, people who have been so aggressive, dismissing fellow writers who have raised what appears to me to be a valid question, that has to be examined.
There is a celebration of Charlie Hebdo in this award. Yet the principle that's being celebrated here is toleration of speech of all kinds. Would you say it's better to leave it at that? And not celebrate speech that's offensive, but simply tolerate it and acknowledge the bravery of Charlie Hebdo, but not single them out as some example to be followed. And that's unfortunately the temptation and the conclusion that may be drawn here.
Yes. What Penn has actually done already, what Penn has made the mistake of doing, is that it has valorized the mockery of a vilified culture. And it therefore incites, in my opinion, things like what Pam Geller did, the unfortunate event in Texas. And indeed, free speech involves not only what Charlie Hebdo was doing, but free speech involves also active critique, the sorts of things that these writers who have protested the Penn decision are doing. And I think that discussion, in some ways, is more necessary than the award itself.
One argument against your position would be that progressives often have this sort of keep quiet and don't offend anyone kind of maxim of political correctness that allows the toleration of all kinds of incremental repression, and that the Charlie Hebdos of the world standing up and saying, no, stop, no, this is outrageous, by calling attention to things that the left is more likely to just ignore, serves a very useful purpose in discourse.
I actually celebrate the fact that Charlie Hebdo is able to puncture that kind of pontificating impulse. I think it is necessary. It's necessary for someone to do that right now, to me, regards what I'm saying to you. Am I being politically correct? I think the term applies more properly to those who are saying freedom of expression has to be celebrated everywhere. I think that by politically correct, I understand that view that is much more acceptable. that view that is much more dominant, that view that in some ways accords with a more acceptable viewpoint. And my question to those folks would be, does it take courage to stand up at a glittering gala in New York City and toast Charlie Hebdo? I don't think it does. So what does it take more courage to stand up for today? Why is it that at this moment, when the U.S., through its many actions, serves as, in my opinion, a recruiting agency for jihad, really, why are those folks who have raised their voices against such actions of the nation state, the terror state, why aren't they in any way acknowledged or rewarded?
Well, I gather you won't be at the gala tonight.
Not only am I opposed in principle, I think my pocket will protest.
Amitabha Kumar teaches at Vassar College. He's a writer and journalist. His forthcoming book is a collection of essays entitled Lunch with a Bigot. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Four-star Army General Ann Dunwoody has a story to tell. She was recruited into the Women's Army Corps at the end of the Vietnam era, watched women join a military demoralized by the uncertainties of those days. She became the first general in charge of the Army's antiquated logistics back in 2000, and after 9/11, she was tested as much as any officer in the military. Ann Dunwoody eventually became the first woman four-star general in the U.S. Army. Her new memoir is A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's Four-Star General. She was delightful and candid, and yesterday when we got backed up in the studio, she told me with a wink, "I admire your courage, son. Keeping a four-star waiting in the green room, never do that." The general is also quite a character.
Yeah, I came in 1975, and we still had the WAC Corps, so I joined the WACs, Women's Army Corps, and shortly after that, they disbanded the Women's Army Corps, and we began this integration of women into the regular Army. And so my first assignment as part of this integration of women no longer in the WAC Corps but in regular Army was to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, as a platoon leader with Sergeant First Class Wendell Bowen. And I was not committed to the Army. I joined the Army because they offered me a lot of money during my senior year in college, $500 a month with a two-year commitment, allowed me to jump out of airplanes and going to commission as a second lieutenant. So even though my family was steeped in military history, I was going to be a coach and a phys ed major. Sergeant Bowen, when I met him, embraced me and told me he was going to make me the best platoon leader, not the best female platoon leader, the best platoon leader in the Army. And he was from Vietnam, and you remember back then we were kind of a broken, hollow Army, but there's nothing broken about Sergeant Wendell Bowen. Hmm. And he taught me what right looked like. He taught me to never walk by a mistake or you just set a new low standard. He was a professional, and he's the reason I stayed longer than my initial 2 years.
So the signal from him was, you know, you got to go along to get along. That wasn't that at all. Because other women, and they sat in that chair that you're sitting in right now from the Army, talk about horrible stories of you got to go along with commanding officers who insist on sort of sexual sort of kinds of things. And the Army has had huge problems with that. The military has. How did you sort of confront that in your own career? And it sounds like Bowen gave you a whole bunch of weapons to deal with.
I think first it starts in your family.
Yep.
And I came from a values-based family, you know, devout mom, Catholic mom, a dad who's a war hero himself, and five brothers and sisters. So I came in the Army out of a values-based system. What I realized is that the military is really a values-based institution too. If you enforce the standards, it's all about standards, it's all about discipline, and it's all about good order. And Wendell taught me from, you know, not wearing your headgear, then you correct that soldier. And if you don't, it's a slippery slope. And that's all standards. It could be picking up trash. It could be watching a soldier do stuff. Not, we didn't have computers back then, but today's playing Facebook or games and not doing their work that you say you're supposed to be working. And you correct these things. You don't ignore them. And the military is a self-policing organization. If we're not policing ourselves, that's in itself another challenge. So I always felt and very comfortable about it because Sergeant Bowen showed me, you know, we're going to inspect the troops. Ma'am, they're not ready for your inspection yet. They don't meet the standard. I'm not going to waste your time. That's the kind of NCO he was.
Did a woman officer ever confide in you about things that she knew were were wrong, that were going on, and wanted your trust?
This is strange. I never worked for a female officer before in my life because we were just beginning this integration, so there were. So I worked only for men who either believed in me or didn't, and fortunately most did. Now, I've had younger females work for me, and they have confided or they have made complaints about behavior that was inappropriate, and you have to investigate. You can't ever turn the other way. There may be nothing there. There may be something there, but you have to, and you owe it to that individual to check out the circumstances and then enforce. You have to have people accountable, and I think that's a, we're wrestling with this as an Army now, holding people accountable for their actions and following up on what that accountability is.
Take it out of the chain of command or –
Absolutely not. I'm not. I appreciate what Senator McCaskill and Senator Gillibrand are doing to highlight the significance of the issue. One assault is too many. But I personally believe, and having spent half of my career in command billets, that the commander must be accountable and responsible. The easiest thing to do is take someone out of command billet if you don't believe that they're capable and worthy of the privilege of command. It's not a right. It's a privilege. And if they abuse that privilege, they don't deserve to be commanding in this great Army of ours.
So what's the lesson from your four stars and being at really the top and seeing the Pentagon really have some difficulty with both of these conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq? And, you know, maybe by the end of it, logistics is not the worst problem, even though at the beginning it probably was the worst problem when you were there.
I think, you know, logistics, we've come a long way. And if you talk to folks that have been over this, probably the two biggest areas we've had a transformation as a result of these wars is medical and our ability to, you know, keep people alive, and logistics, getting the stuff they need when they need it, how much they need it, and how quickly they need it. I think from – you have to – you know this. Our military is – works for civilian leadership. And I think what I do believe is our leaders always – and they – fully provide their best advice and counsel to civilian leadership. And then at the end of the day, our civilian leadership is responsible for those decisions.
But the uniformed and the civilian planets are drifting apart, it seems like, in America. And you write about it in here.
Yep. My toughest job in the military was my 3 years in the Pentagon as the G4. And that friction that existed and trying to bridge that, because I believe that with communication, collaboration, cooperation, we as a team, and we are a team, that you have to embrace them. You might have differences, but you got to talk about them. There's going to be some compromise sometimes. There may not be compromise. And if you can't come to agreement, then you have personal choices about what you do.
But America at large doesn't get involved in the military. Very few people serve. It's a huge story. It's a huge issue for all Americans. But we're as isolated from our military as we've ever been.
Yeah. Well, less than 1% of the military will ever – I mean, American population will ever serve. That's why I'm really proud to be on a leadership council which is trying to institute and incorporate a national service. Not everyone's cut out for the military, but everyone, I believe, can do something to give back to this great country.
General Ann Dunwoody, the first woman to become a four-star general in the U.S. Army, whose new memoir is A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's Four-Star General. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Far From the Madding Crowd, the new film based on Thomas Hardy's classic love story, starring Carey Mulligan, Matthias Schoenaert, Michael Sheen, and Tom Sturridge, in select theaters now.
So we're at halftime here at The Takeaway. You want to stick around for the second half, of course. A reminder, we are on Twitter at The Takeaway. Please do follow us there. And you can follow me at Jay Hockenberry. I'll answer your tweets. What you're listening to is really only made possible by those who contribute to public radio. If you do, thank you. If you don't, please think about giving whatever you can to your local public radio station. They need it, and you'll feel good about being part of a community that values stories like this.
Cinco de Mayo on Tuesday, and I hoped we'd see each other again.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Look at the calendar. It's Cinco de Mayo, the Mexican day to celebrate sinks.
Yeah, right.
No. I know something about history.
5th of May, Cinco de Mayo, margaritas, tacos, piñatas, Mexican independence, independence of Mexico.
What?
John. Excuse me?
Oh, man. No.
Alex Estrada is with us.
No, John.
He's with the Upright Citizens Brigade and the Univision, the Flama Network.
Flama.
Flama Network?
The Flama,
so
yes.
Basically, I'm just a gringo here.
No. You're all right, John. I know you're all right.
So what's wrong with Cinco de Mayo?
Well, there's nothing wrong with Cinco de Mayo per se. It's more of what's wrong is the way it's celebrated, the way it's couched. A lot of people think that it celebrates Mexican independence, but it doesn't. It actually recognizes a very important battle that the Mexicans had with the French back in 1862, Battle of Puebla, where a small Mexican force held off French invasion of about twice the number. You know, people assume that, oh, yeah, it's Mexican Independence Day. And, you know, with that, they take it as a celebration of Mexican culture. However, it's been co-opted more or less the last couple of years to be more about, it seems, getting drunk and buying things, eating tacos and that kind of thing.
Do they celebrate Cinco de Mayo in Mexico?
Yeah, they do. It's actually more of a regional celebration, specifically in the state where Puebla is located. But it's not actually a national holiday.
It's not a national holiday.
Not a national holiday, no.
And there's no religious significance to
no,
it.
No. Lord, no.
And in terms of the way Americans celebrate it, it feels offensive?
Yeah, I think it's offensive to some extent. I remember a few years ago, I was walking down the street on Cinco de Mayo, and this sort of it wasn't quite a parade. It was smaller than that, but a bunch of white guys walking through wearing sombreros and ponchos, and they were basically doing sort of a pub crawl, more or less, going from Mexican-themed restaurant bar to Mexican-themed restaurant bar, celebrating. And, you know, I looked at that, and I think it's, you know, I didn't throw up in my mouth right then and there. But
you went into the first Vietnamese restaurant.
Exactly.
You could find,
yeah.
But is it in ignorance of Mexico that gets celebrated on the 5th, and that if it was more of an understanding of what went on during history by Americans, that would make it less offensive?
I think it would. I think it's one of those things where it's divorced from the context in which it occurred. And as a result, it feels like sort of a cheapening of the culture in a way, a cheapening of the holiday. It'd be if Canada celebrated the Battle of Ticonderoga, which was a very important battle in the Revolutionary War, and took that as an excuse to go out and get drunk and eat American food and sort of understood that to be, yeah, this is the how we celebrate American culture. When in fact, the Battle of Ticonderoga was a very small battle towards the larger goal of independence that culminated, of course, with the Battle of Yorktown and eventually the defeat of the English in the Revolutionary War.
Well, what holiday would be a great one to celebrate?
For
Americans to express maybe more solidarity with our brothers to the south.
With our brothers to the south. Well, there's actual Mexican Independence Day, which is on September 16th.
Okay.
That recognizes sort of the foundation of the modern Mexican state as it exists. And then also, of course, Cesar Chavez Day.
There's a lot of interest in Day of the Dead.
All right. Yeah, there's that as well. That one's a bit more polarizing, I've found, just because it sort of does have a religious tint to it to some extent.
And it's not a real cheerful.
No. The sugar skulls freak me out.
Alex Estrada, Mexican-American comedian in New York City, writes sketch comedy for the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York and has written comedy for Univision, the Flama Network.
There you go.
Thanks so much.
No problem.
Happy Cinco de Mayo.
Happy Cinco de Mayo.
Don't hit me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
We take you now to a slow-breaking human interest story.
Some exclusive news this morning. That big, innocent, delightful bird on the Sesame Street show? The yellow bird, who was always so sweet and willing to help, said to be a big, gangly 6-year-old. Big Bird is married.
It really was this wonderful union, and it's still to this day we're as close as can be.
That's right. Exclusively here on The Takeaway, Big Bird's wife, Deborah Spinney. She opened up about the challenges of hanging in there with an old bird for over 40 years.
It's a lot of fun, I can say that.
Deborah Spinney is the wife of Carol Spinney, the Muppeteer who's played Big Bird from the very beginning. Carol is also the actor-puppeteer who plays Oscar the Grouch. Grouchy Oscar is Carol's jolly old id, Big Bird, kind of a giant yellow superego. Altogether, they make up a remarkable love story. Big Bird, Carol, Oscar, and of course, Deborah. The story is told in the new film, I Am Big Bird, the Carol Spinney story.
All rehearsed, all ready to go to see somebody special. One of our biggest yellow feathered friends. Who is it? You got it.
I think it was most apparent to us the first time we really got out and performed for kids. Every time you mentioned Big Bird, the place erupted. It was like a mini Woodstock.
You can make your own comparisons, as Deborah told us. The documentary is part biography, part love story, and part Muppet magic.
When I met Carol, he had three children, and then when I met him, there were 6, 4, and 2, Jesse, Melissa, and Ben. And he asked me to marry him 13 days later after our first date. So now I'm going to face being a stepmom really quickly and meeting the kids, and oh gosh, I was petrified they were not going to want me to marry him. You know, like, it was scary. So when we did get together, it was Jesse, the oldest, who said to me, "Are you going to marry my daddy?" And I was so nervous, but I kind of tried to smile my best smile. And I said, "Yes, I am." And she put her hand out, took my hand, and said, "Good, then we're going to call you Mommy." She turned to Melissa and Ben and said, "See her? We're going to call her Mommy from now on." And they went, "Okay, that's fine." Ben said, "Carry me." I picked him up, and I think I carried him for 2 years.
So finally, it was just heavy, joyous. It's all a big pickup.
I mean, it was from the first day, we were a family, which was a miracle in itself. And it's still to this day, we're as close as can be.
I mean, this film, as we see in the movie, you know, it's really your relationship is part of what drives the warmth and even just the energy of Big Bird all over the world.
I think it took us by surprise. We are thinking it's really going to be a movie just about Carol and Sesame Street and how it all happened. And then when we watched, we were flabbergasted that it really was a love story. People say it inspires them, so that's a nice thing.
You know, all this sweetness and light is just making me sick.
Oh, here's Oscar.
Yeah.
How did you get in here, Oscar?
I stuck in while the door was open.
Oscar, are you jealous of Big Bird because he gets maybe a little more attention than you?
No, I hate people looking at me.
Really?
Yeah. Good thing I'm not on television.
Yeah, right.
I think you are.
No kidding.
What? I'm on TV. You didn't tell me. Well, we knew you'd react poorly.
Oscar, if you ever found out that you were just a puppet, how would you feel about that?
I wouldn't be happy about it. I'm a real grouch. I love trash, too. Oh, I love trash. You don't have to sing, Oscar.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Anything dirty or dingy or dusty, anything rotten or ragged or rusty, oh, I love trash.
So can I talk to Big Bird for a moment?
I'm right here.
Big Bird, it's great to have you here on The Takeaway.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
And anything scare you about the radio? Are you nervous? Are you feeling perfectly comfortable?
I can't see anybody except you.
Uh-huh.
You look great.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And what would you say is the most important quality, your best quality?
I'm friendly. I never bite or peck. And I just try to be a good friend.
Why Big? Why Bird? And what was the original inspiration for Big Bird? We can't imagine there would be no Big Bird, but there was a time when there was no Big Bird.
That's right. Well, Jim Henson had already created Ernie and Bert for
sure.
as some test pilots for Sesame Street, which was not on the air yet. And so they said that they'd like to bring a little more fantasy to the street scenes. And so they asked him to come up with a couple of characters who could be there every day, because Jim couldn't be there every day. He was very busy with other things. So he came up with the Big Bird. He'd always wanted to make a silly puppet that you're so big you get in and you're his legs. But he's a puppet because his head is not just on your head like a costume, but sits in my right hand, held up high over my head. He named it Big Bird, and he got the name Oscar from a grouchy waiter at a place called Oscar's over on 3rd Avenue. He was a funny grouch.
And so you got both of those characters.
Yeah.
How has this lasted so long, do you think? There's a magic and an almost eternity quality to so many of these characters.
Yeah, well, there's been some characters that have come and gone. You know, for instance, I was very close with Granny Fanny Nesselrode.
Right.
But the show has been, it was called Experiment in Television. Debbie used to be with a group called the Research Department, and they would check, they would show things to various groups of kids and record their reactions, and they were a little bored with Granny Fanny Nesselrode.
Land sakes, I'm still here, never get anything to say. Oh, dear.
Well, we miss you.
Yes.
How many more characters does he have in him, Deborah?
I want to say a lot, but really not too many. You know,
yeah.
He's a lot like Big Bird. He's sometimes like Oscar the Grouch, but
only when he's driving.
That's probably true.
Big Bird, Oscar, Deborah, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Did I say that? What's wrong with me?
That was very polite, Oscar.
Yeah.
Maybe you should
give
him an aspirin.
I must have gotten up on the right side of the bed.
Yeah, he needs a pill or something.
Yeah.
Thank you, Carol.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks. Nice to be here.
I Am Big Bird, the Carol Spinney story, is out on video on demand today and in limited release starting tomorrow, May 6th. My in-depth interview with Oscar the Grouch with All the Dirt is available at takeaway.org. And as you know, Big Bird can get sad sometimes. What was the saddest thing that ever happened to Big Bird, to you?
Well, Mr. Looper died.
That's Hooper.
Oh, yeah, Hooper. Mr. Looper died, and he was such a wonderful grandfather, I almost thought of him as my grandfather. And we lost him, and I didn't understand that he wouldn't come back. Now I understand. It's sad when somebody dies. They don't come back, but we remember them and try to honor them because we love them.
So we ask kids, how would you cheer up Big Bird?
I don't feel perfect every day. We're all human. What could you do to make me feel a little better today?
My name is Isabel. I would say, Big Bird, are you okay? I would say, I will help you. I would say, Big Bird, I would play with you.
My name is Malcolm. Send them a picture.
My name is Soraya. I want to give them a hug.
My name is Julian.
I'll help them. I'll make them a cake.
My name is Will. Big Bird, I'll give you a hug.
Don't worry if it's not good enough for anyone else.
Preschoolers at PS 118 to the rescue right here in New York City. Thanks, kids. We'll be hearing more from Carol Spinney and Big Bird later this hour. And for all our little listeners out there, we want to hear from you today. What would you tell Big Bird to help cheer him up?
Hi, Big Bird. My name's Grace, and I'm from sunny South Florida. I hope you're happy today. Good luck on your radio show. Bye.
Grace, I'm sure he's feeling better already. Come on, everybody. Let's help Big Bird feel better. And that's what you could take with you today.
Hi, my name is Andrea Harris, and I am from Bronx, New York. Big Bird, you always made my children so happy when they woke up in the morning and I wanted to sleep.
This is Nisa from Pensacola, New Jersey.
Hi, Big Bird. Don't be blue. We love you. Have a nice day.
Bye.
Hi, I'm J.D. Fisher. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and I have a song to cheer up Big Bird.
B-A-B, B-A-Y. B-A, Bicky Bay, B-A, bye, Bicky Bay, bye, bo, Bicky Boo, Bicky Bay, bye, bo. Big Bird, I hope you feel better. Bye.
Nice, Zadie. That's all for today, but you can join our conversation. Call us, sing to Big Bird,
We are very open. 877-8-MY-TAKE. And you can ask me anything on Twitter every day. But today I only take questions about my interview with Big Bird. Hit me up at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.